Thank you, Ghazal. Yeah, thank you for the invitation to visit here and also a chance to speak here. This doesn't have any cosmology, but there's gravitation. Okay, so this is some work I did with Hari Kunduri at McMaster University. The goal was to say something, even in a very small sense, about the stability of space-times. So I'll start with the framework here, which is, we are looking at asymptotically flat stationary solutions to Einstein equations. So we are using basically modeling equilibrium states. So this is, this is a system that we are looking at, and that is the focus here. There is no cosmological constant, and what we would like to do is to understand the stability of space-times as solutions to the Einstein field equations, or answer more precisely what happens to small perturbations. So before we get into the result, what does stability mean here? So these equations are a second order PDE system because the Ricci curvature has a second order dependence on the metric. But then as a PDE system, what is its nature? Is it elliptic? Is it hyperbolic? Or is it parabolic? Because the way you treat a PDE depends on what the character of the PDE is. So if it's elliptic, you would pose it as a boundary value problem. But if it's hyperbolic or if it has a wave-like nature, you would be posing it as an initial value problem. So that is the first question. And unfortunately, long after the Einstein field equations were proposed, the type of the PDEs that were underlying these equations were hidden, partly because of the covariance. There's no coordinate specified in these field equations, which is good because we want physics to be written out in a coordinate independent way, but then that also made the form of PDEs very hard to uncover. Close to 50 years after the field equations were proposed, Choquet-Bruhat and Guiroche exploited this coordinate freedom. So they used what are called harmonic coordinates or wave coordinates, which made the nature of the Einstein field equations very clear. So they have this hyperbolic nature. So for hyperbolic PDEs, they are well posed as an initial value problem as opposed to a boundary value problem. So that is the way we would be studying the Einstein field equations. That is, we give initial conditions at a specific point in time. Okay, so what this is will be clarified in a minute. Okay, so for Einstein field equations, the initial data is a space-like hypersurface. So this is just a Riemannian manifold. And for wave equations, you usually specify the initial position and its derivative. So similar to that here, the initial position is this space-like hypersurface and its derivative is its extrinsic curvature with respect to the time-like normal. So this triplet is the initial data. So sigma is this Riemannian manifold or the space-like hypersurface. H is the Riemannian metric on this manifold. And K is the extrinsic curvature. Now, very similar to what happens in electromagnetism, this data is not free. So in one-dimensional wave equation, this data is free. You can specify any function as the initial position and the initial velocity, but this data is not free, it's constrained, similar to the divergence-less condition in electromagnetism. And these are constrained by what are called the Gauss and Kodaly equations. So these equations basically, which are given here, they basically encode the relationship between the ambient curvature, the intrinsic and the extrinsic curvature of this a space-like hypersurface. So there is a difference to a circle being embedded in R2 versus a circle being embedded on a cylinder, right? So the extrinsic curvature is going to change because the normal to the circle is going to be different in both the cases. And so there's a specific relationship between the intrinsic curvature of the circle and how this circle is embedded. So that is what the Gauss and Kodaly equations tell you. And so this initial data is constrained by these equations. Okay, so given that, we come to the existence and uniqueness result. For any differential equation, we would like to know where you can actually reasonably find a solution. So that is the existence and uniqueness result here. So given initial data, that satisfy the constraint equations, there's a unique globally hyperbolic maximal spacetime that this initial data embeds into with, you know, the initial conditions with the metric H and the extrinsic curvature K. Okay, so the summary of all these results is what we have to take away to the next slide is we have an initial value formulation for the Einstein field equations, and this is what we would be using to understand stability, to understand how perturbations behave in this in a background spacetime. And the initial data with the constraints won't really show up in what we are trying to do here, as you'll see shortly. So the initial data and the evolution equations and the existence and uniqueness are all going to tell us how to deal with perturbations. Okay. Yes.
Is what you're saying as specific to the gauge you mentioned before, or is this
No. So this, so the result, the gauge was helpful in uncovering what the nature of these equations were, but this result has nothing to do with the gauge. And another way of saying that is, if I have a space like, slice, there are different choices for the time-like vectors that come out of the slice, and you can evolve along any of them. So this doesn't depend on that. I didn't write the evolution equations here, but there is a lapse and shift, and there is that freedom, and that is the same as saying there's no coordinate dependence on this formulation.
So the fact that you develop singularities at some point, how does that come
out? So this, though it says globally hyperbolic, this result tells you that there is existence in a neighborhood of the initial data.
Okay.
So what happens much, much later on, what happens when time goes to infinity, we don't really know. And that is exactly also what we're trying to find out about the perturbations.
There is an existence theorem, a uniqueness theorem, if you start with that constraint.
Yes.
And only given that it doesn't matter how sick, the values of, nothing else matters.
No, as long as my initial data is satisfying the constraint, it's proper initial data, and it's just going to satisfy. It's just going to give you a solution. Now, how long the solution is going to be existing for, that remains to be seen. Yeah.
So these constraints,
yes.
Aren't these the same as gauge invariance or gauge freedom, or are these different from?
So this is not really the gauge freedom. These constraints. So you can also think of them as telling you what the mass density is on the hypersurface and the momentum, the initial momentum density is on the hypersurface. That's one way of seeing it. From a differential geometry point of view, these just relate your intrinsic curvature to your extrinsic curvature. So extrinsic curvature is dictated by how the normal to a surface, which is embedded in a bigger manifold changes, so how that is related to this. So those are all, those don't really depend on any gauges. It's just a...
But they are consequences of gauge symmetry.
Yeah, they're consequences of diffeomorphism invariance, right?
Because
one is the, aren't there the momentum and energy conservation?
So that's a Hamiltonian and momentum constraint.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
So they are like a 3D and one, or time and space.
Yes. So this would be like the T00, and that would be the T0i.
Yeah.
But that's gauge dependent, is it?
Because
when it's
you
a
become
statement of gauge independence, so gauge freedom.
Probably. Oh, I see. Okay.
So once you do the decomposition, then they manifest themselves, right? It is
yes.
Yes.
I see. Okay.
It's both gauge and gauge invariance.
Okay, I see. I see. Okay. Now I understand. Okay.
There's the actual equations for gauge freedoms, right? So you have four constraint equations, and you should have another four gauge conditions that you can impose.
I see. Okay. So there are four more conditions for.
But if you want to have unique solutions, you need to fix the gauge.
So those come in the evolution equations, I think, the lapse and shift. Okay, so that's where we are. Okay, now the question we would like to answer is how much does the geometry change? That is, how much does the space-time metric g change if the initial data is slightly perturbed? And addressing this in full generality is a very difficult problem because the Einstein equations are coupled and nonlinear. So a simple model to study the behavior of perturbations is just to look at what happens to this one scalar function which propagates in the background of a particular spacetime. And the initial value formulation and the evolution equations for that are just this wave equation, but then in the background of the metric G and with these initial conditions. Okay. So the questions we would like to answer are, if phi is a perturbation, ignoring any back reaction or any nonlinear terms, and we ask, does this remain bounded? So if you throw a pebble in a pond, you don't want the waves to be really, really high. And does this phi decay eventually? And the way, and what I mean by decay will be made precise later. And again, going back to the pond, you just want the ripples to die down eventually. So those are the two questions we would like to answer here. Okay, so I'll start with the review of the stability problem. It has a rich and long history. And the earliest results about stability were by Whiting and Regge, whose results were primarily on mode stability. So this talks about the absence of certain exponentially growing modes. Now, that is the result definitely has a lot of value, but then it doesn't tell us everything about perturbations, because when you look at perturbations with these boundary conditions, say in a black hole spacetime, with a horizon and infinity, you cannot have a expansion in a full basis. So just the absence of these modes doesn't give you the full picture. It doesn't tell you
it's probably not that old. Probably 1985.
Oh, 80. Okay, I might have. Okay, yeah, sure. I'll change that. Okay. Sorry about that. Yes. Okay. And I think I just didn't mention the dates for anything else. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. And the result for Minkowski, and so that doesn't tell us the complete picture. And the first full nonlinear stability result for arbitrary perturbations was by Christodoulou and Kleinerman in this massive work in the 1990s, I think. And since then, because the techniques there were fundamental in developing more methods to deal with black hole spacetimes, there has been a lot of results in the last few decades. Notably, there is a stability result for Schwarzschild by Duffelmoser, Rodniansky, and extremal black holes. In contrast to what happens for Schwarzschild or Kerr. They have a kind of instability along the horizon. And the recent progress is, I'm not going to go through all of them, and the recent progress in this direction is that there is a nonlinear stability result for Schwarzschild, and there's also some progress in the nonlinear stability of Kerr. Okay. The spacetimes that we will be interested in are what are called gravitational solitons, and the name is in line with the kind of solutions or the kind of standing wave solutions you see in physics and optics.
Sorry, before we get into that, this nonlinear stability of Schwarzschild, can you say, are you going to talk about that, or have you ever heard about it?
Okay. So I haven't even gone through the introduction of that paper. It's 500 pages long.
But that's the claim, that Schwarzschild is unstable?
Oh, it's stable.
Is it stable?
Yes, yes. Oh, okay. So yeah, Schwarzschild is stable in this bigger family of, close by. Yes. Okay, not interesting.
Sorry,
okay. Yes.
Can I interject?
Oh, yes.
No, Schwarzschild cannot be stable, right? Any perturbation that has any angular momentum will create a Kerr black hole. So I guess you're saying with a very special set of initial conditions, right?
Oh, so Schwarzschild's stability in the larger class of Kerr spacetimes look at something that has a, when it's perturbed, it would be something that would develop a small angular momentum. So in a certain sense, it's still close to the original solution. That is the sense in which I'm calling it stable.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, that was a good good point. Okay, so yeah, the kind of spacetimes that we would be interested in here are what are called gravitational solitons. These are globally regular. It just means that it doesn't have a horizon. It doesn't have a singularity. So it's not a naked singularity spacetime. It's stationary, and it's asymptotically flat. And positive energy. So I just added positive energy here because with everything else that's in the first line, one can assume that, okay, this just has to be the trivial Minkowski spacetime, but it's not, and such solutions are possible in five dimensions and higher. So this, the proof that such solutions don't exist in four dimensions was given by Leichnerowicz, and that's a proof from more than 40 years back, but with the positive mass theorem and other results recently, we can see it in a very simple way. So let me go through this proof because it's just nice. Let's look at an asymptotically flat spacetime with a time-like killing vector field. So it's a stationary spacetime. And we're looking at solutions to the Einstein-Maxwell theory. So these are the two field equations, but written in this differential forms language. So it'll just be four equations. Because the spacetime is simply connected, then this field equation is going to imply that this interior product is going to be generated by an electric potential. So this comes from Cartan's formula. You have a relationship between the Lie derivative, the exterior derivative, and the interior product. So that tells me that this one form is not just closed, but also exact. Okay, so because the space is simply connected, one forms which are closed will also be exact. And the same thing happens here. This is a one form, so it's an interior product with respect to this time-like killing vector field, and that's also going to be exact. So we have these two potentials generating these two one forms. And how is this going to be useful? Let's look at the expression for the mass from the Komar formula. So this is an expression for the mass. I convert it to an integral along sigma. And then I use the Ricci identity, and then I use the field equations to get here. But because we know that this is actually, this is actually closed, and it has, it's generated by this exact form, I can write this as, this form. So now, if I don't have any inner boundary, that is, if I don't really have any horizon, I can just take this to infinity, and that's just going to be zero. So unless I have an inner horizon, this is just going to give me zero mass. And when it's zero mass, then the result of Shane and Yao tells us that the only zero mass spacetime is Minkowski. Minkowski has zero mass, and the only, it's an if and only if. So that gives us that it's trivial. So what we've concluded is that there are no asymptotically flat gravitational solitons in 4D Einstein-Maxwell theory. So all these conditions are important, stationary, of course, and also asymptotically flat, because you can have examples where you don't have asymptotic flatness.
Question, where did you use a stationarity in this?
So I used it in the previous. Okay, so the Lie derivative and commuting it with Lie x over of d omega is equal to zero. That tells me that this commutes with the, so this is ik df. That's where I used it. Yeah, so both those formulas, yeah.
So what
question?
Yes.
Can I go?
Okay, Luis, you go first.
What? Thank you. So this is for the case of a soliton made out of gauge fields, but is it possible to entertain solitons made out of scalar fields?
Scalar fields. There are no known solutions, but...
In 4D, we have boson stars, for instance, which are the next kin. So I wonder where, what sort of restrictions are you considering to kind of censor all these possibilities? That's fine. So if you are saying we're not going to consider scalar fields, that's okay, perhaps.
Let's see. So the only assumption, it's not an assumption. So the Only thing I'm using here is that my space like slice, like the sigma, is simply connected. So unless that is being violated.
No, you're also assuming that your only fields are the metric field and the Maxwell field.
So I'm positive that there are no known solutions, but I cannot come up with.
Well, this complex scalars that Lewis was talking, they can get these boson stars, I believe.
But if the rest mass of the compact scalar field is zero, like the EM field here, do you still get a boson star? Can you still get a boson star?
I don't know.
So it wouldn't be a one form anymore. Is that what you need? Or what do you need for the head to, for this to go through?
Just the Maxwell equation. So, you know, both F and star F are closed. That's all I need.
Rest mass is zero, right? For,
Yes. The rest.
So boson stars are for massive complex scalars.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess for massless scalars.
I see.
You don't know.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
Yeah, but then there are also oscillons, and of course, where they are long-term, long-lived, that's one story. But here, it's a different question, which is, this you're trying to address where a solution will kind of leave the space-time with the same structure, whatever, and establish some non-trivial existence results. So then I could also consider oscillons. And so these are just scalar fields. I don't even need to consider a complex scalar field.
But that's not a solution, a stationary solution of Einstein equation. That's, I mean, these are exact theorems, and I guess oscillons don't satisfy them, but I guess.
What I'm saying is, like, if we're gonna dismiss the possibility that is there because we're only assuming Maxwell fields and gravity, okay, how generic it is, given that I can put a scalar field and I can generate solutions. That are non-trivial in simply connected spacetimes.
I see. Okay. I'm not aware of the existence or non-existence of those solutions. Just to clarify, so all these solutions, no naked singularities, they are stationary, asymptotically flat. Is it? They're all okay. I see. Okay.
For a complex massive vector field too, as opposed to scalar.
I'll look into that. I'm not sure.
You wanted to answer?
Oh, yes, yeah. Sorry, yeah.
What is there in the red assumptions for solitons that kills the existence for 4D? So let's say if I have empty space-time, zero positive energy.
Yeah, that's then, just Minkowski.
So then it exists. So it's a positive energy that kills the 4D.
Oh, no. So the result of, Shane and Yao tells you that if you have a space-time with zero mass, then it's a if and only if it can only be Minkowski. So that's just like the trivial thing. So the positive.
What the punchline was for the proof that Minkowski can exist.
You cannot have non-trivial spacetimes in four-dimensional, Einstein-Maxwell. Yeah. Yeah, before this discussion, I used to think the topological restriction was the major, constraint here, but perhaps not so, yeah. Yeah, because once you go to higher dimensions, then, you don't have this duality between F and star F. These are both one forms, which are closed. If this is, if there's a two form, this will be a three form, and then you cannot go through the same arguments, so.
Is there anything about this line?
De-sitter. So in general, I would say a lot less is known about existence. Even looking at black holes, there when you add cosmological constant, a lot of the arguments that you have, For example, even in the integral that came in later, like one of the terms just goes to zero because you're looking at those decay conditions at infinity. Yeah. So yeah, de Sitter, I'm not really sure. Maybe there's more on it, you know, anti de Sitter, because all these things came up in string theory a while back. Okay, right. So that's the, you know, summary here. There are no asymptotically flat gravitational solitons in four-dimensional, just pure Einstein-Maxwell theory. So the solution that was just to give a motivation for why I'm looking at something in five dimensions. So the space-time that we are looking at is a solution to this action. So this is just the usual Einstein-Maxwell. And the last term there, that is a nonlinear electromagnetic term. And these are the field equations that you have. And you know, for Einstein-Maxwell, this would just be zero, but then you can see that this is somehow sourced by this, you know, nonlinear term. That is exactly what gives rise to the mass and the charge in this space-time. And
sorry, where did that nonlinear term come from?
So this is a, so I don't have a lot of background in string theory, but this is a Chern-Simons term, and it's a supergravity theory. And this is one of the solutions, for a supergravity theory. It's not supersymmetric, but the theory I think is supersymmetric.
That coefficient is fixed somehow, 8/3.
Yeah. So there is, if anyone knows more string theory, please feel free to correct me. But my understanding is that there is a bosonic part to the action and a fermionic part, and for this, supersymmetry to be maintained, that 8/3√3 is kind of crucial, like for the transformations to make sense. Yeah.
This looks like the action for force free field.
For force free, you mean force free electromagnetic?
Yeah.
In 4D, though?
Yeah,
in 4D. But does that have Fs squared in it? There's like A.B or something.
I don't know about the coefficient, but actually.
You mean it's 8/3.
Yeah.
Oh, I see, the 8/ okay. I see, okay. And one of the solutions to this action is this really nice, soliton solutions. I didn't write down all the, metric functions here, but these are all rational functions, and these are the ranges of the coordinates. What we need to take, all the important points that we want to take out from here are, it's an asymptotically flat solution, and it has this R times SU time, SU2 times U1 isometry. So all this means is, if you have a, for example, a five-dimensional, rotating black hole, this is not a black hole, but your two angular momenta are equal. So that's what this, symmetry is. And it's a one-parameter family, and that parameter can either, be the source for your mass or charge, and they're related by that parameter. And this is the topology of these space-like slices. And the most important thing is this dt is globally time-like, and there are no Urger regions. So that fails when you have a horizon, or when you have a rotating black hole. They were of interest in string theory because they could give you some explanation, they were conjectured to give you some explanation for the entropy of black holes. These are spacetimes which have a certain mass, and so you can think of them as, being degenerate states for other black holes with, a similar mass or charge. Okay, so the takeaway here is our choice of background is a globally regular or horizonless spacetime. It's non-trivial, so it has positive mass. And it's asymptotically flat and stationary. And so all these conditions are going to be useful when we look at some computations later on. Okay, so let me just look at how much time do I have?
Half an hour.
Oh, okay, great. Nice.
I ask you another question?
Yes.
So if we go back to the stability of Minkowski.
Oh, yes.
I vaguely recall, and maybe it's my recollection is incorrect, but kind of establishing the stability of Minkowski in higher dimensions is much simpler than in four dimensions. Remembering correctly?
Yes, yeah, that is what I've heard. I would think it's because of the symmetries that you have.
I thought it would be because of the dispersion and the 1/r.
The dispersion as well. I think the dispersion plays a bigger role. But I haven't gone through the.
Okay, right. Thank you. Yeah. Now, just trying to put this in context. You're studying things in five dimensions now, and trying to see how much of these.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Maybe the result will be a little anticlimactic then, because we'll prove that something decays much slower than we expected to. So, yeah. Okay. So before we go back looking at the waves. Let's look at the behavior of null geodesics in the spacetimes because, in the high-frequency regimes, waves travel along null geodesics. So to get some intuition, though this won't be, useful in the actual proof, let's look at the null geodesics. So there are these isometries. There's also a Killing tensor. And so you can, write down this nice equation for the radial null geodesics. And when you plot it, this is the form of, this is the kind of the plot that you get. So what is curious here is there is this big region where you cannot have any geodesics, and there is this confined region. So the range of R, it's open R0 to infinity. So there is this region, an open set, where your geodesics can be confined. It's not a surface like it is in Schwarzschild, which is a photon sphere at R is equal to 3m. It is an open set. Where these geodesics are confined. And this kind of trapping of null geodesics is called stable trapping. And it's indicative of dynamical instability. It's conjectured that when you look at nonlinear perturbations, then these waves have a tendency to clump and then cause instabilities. Okay.
Is this a conjecture? Like if you have this trapped geodesics, do you always have nonlinear instability? Or, is there any numerical evidence that?
No. So there is no known proof. In fact, Bill and I were talking about this. There is no known proof, but I don't know how. So when you have a polynomial type decay for your waves, your perturbations in the nonlinear regime or even gravitational regime are expected to decay. But when you have something logarithmic, it's considered not strong enough. Now, the exact relationship between where is the fine point, like what kind of decay is the optimal to go to nonlinear instability, I'm not really sure. I mean, there's no mechanism for how this is going to appear, no known mechanism for how this is going to appear.
Is this empirically at least been the case? Or are there?
So if there is some kind of dynamical instability, then maybe these solutions would just, I know this is five dimensions, but yeah, if it were four dimensions, maybe these solutions would just not be observable because I'm looking at stationary, states. But empirical, yeah, I'm not really sure. So a similar kind of trapping has been proved for what are called ultra-compact neutron stars. But I'm not aware of any, observational side of things those.
There's some solutions that have the same property and the same instability occurs.
I see. There isn't anything that. I don't know if you have an answer for it.
Yeah, that's maybe but as far as I know, there are not any examples of non-linear instability for one of these things that has linear stability but slow decay.
At least as far as we are aware, I don't think anyone has gone beyond the wave equation to look at these solutions. There is that as well.
When are you going to do? Did you look at ultra compact neutron stars at some point? I somehow have this recollection.
I'm interested in that. I said we're interested in trying to answer this question.
But I see. But you haven't actually simulated it.
Yeah. There are favorite things. But
you don't think.
Yes. Okay. So for Schwarzschild, there is a photon sphere, so you do have this confinement of null geodesics, and it presents some difficulties when you want to rigorously prove decay, but not as much as stable trapping. Okay. So now we are interested in the soliton spacetime where there is stable trapping, but then so far I've been talking about geodesics. What we want to be talking about is, you know, solutions to the wave equation. So how can one actually go about understanding that? So how does stable trapping actually affect how the waves decay? Okay, so now let's go back to the waves and let's take this evolutionary picture. Let's start with the foliation and prescribe data on sigma zero. And this is a stress energy tensor for a massless scalar field, and the equation of motion for a stress energy tensor like this is what the wave equation is. And if I take two future-directed time-like vectors, then this is always positive definite. Now you can understand this from the dominant energy condition, but also you can do an explicit calculation and see that it's just going to be a square of derivatives for this function. And this is also divergence-free from the Bianchi identity. And the divergence-freeness of this and the fact that this is a time-like, killing vector field, that T is a time-like killing vector field, tells you that this is divergence-free. So, the grad Q is divergence-free automatically, and this is just going to end up being the Lie derivative of G with respect to this killing vector field. So that's just equal to zero. So whenever we have something that's divergence-free, instinctively integrated on a region of space-time, and look at what happens in the boundaries, what you get at the boundary. So let's integrate this on the space-time region. And what I would get is that this is conserved on a space-like hypersurface. Or also what is more relevant to us is that, so these derivatives, the integral of these squares of derivatives are conserved. So from this, what we get is that there is some time-dependent quantity that relates to initial data, and that is conserved. Okay, so now with these conserved quantities, I can construct what are called energies, which are nothing but just the integral of these conserved quantities. So this is just the first order energy. It's a derivative, all the derivatives on sigma. This also includes the time derivatives. And then we also have these higher order energies, which are square integrals of these higher derivatives. And then we also have what is called a local energy, that is the energy over a small region. And something like that, this is important because you ultimately want to talk about how things disperse from a small region. Okay. And the goal here would be to optimally relate this initial energy and this final energy. So you want the best possible way to bound the final energy in terms of the initial energy. Okay, so precisely these notions are called boundedness. So you want to ask if my final energy is going to be bounded by the initial energy. And then you also want to know, because boundedness is not enough, you also want to know if these perturbations somehow decay. So you want to know if, in a local region, you can bound this local energy by the initial energy, but then multiplied by some decaying function of time. So these are the two questions that you would like to answer. And we saw that this is globally stationary. And the reason this is important is unless you have something that's globally stationary and time-like, this is not going to be positive definite, right? So for a soliton, it's a very straightforward calculation to understand that my energy is bounded. Now we can compare this to the case of black holes because they also have an inner boundary, which is a horizon. So when I do this integral, space-time integral over a black hole, I don't just have these two space-like surfaces, but I also have to deal with what is happening on the horizon. And there, a part of my sigma is, so if I take this to be my final sigma, a part of it is null. So there is some ways in which some of the derivatives are not controlled by the initial energy. So that poses some problems. But for solitons, that's not the case. And we have boundedness. OK, now what about decay? So for decay, even without doing any further work, there is a result of Mushidis that states the following. For any globally hyperbolic spacetime, which is stationary and asymptotically flat, you know, which can possibly contain black holes with a non-degenerate horizon and a small ergo region, it's not relevant for us because we don't have a black hole. For which an energy boundedness statement is true, which we know is true for the soliton, the solutions decay at least logarithmically. Okay, so we don't know if a faster decay is possible, but this theorem tells us that you have at least logarithmic decay. Okay, so this is also applicable for the soliton. Now the question is, can you do any better? So having an upper bound which is logarithmic doesn't mean that you cannot have an upper bound which is polynomial, right? Polynomial decay meaning 1 over t raised to something. So that's faster decay.
Sorry, question.
Yeah.
What is omega?
So this is just a local energy. So it's just a small space-time region. And we are looking at how, you know, this disperses in time or, you know, decays in time.
So you take a finite region of a space.
Yes.
Asking how this energy in that region.
Yeah, how that is decaying with respect to the initial energy, yeah. Yes, so, well, if I look at least for the soliton, if I look at, you know, the whole energy that is conserved, so I cannot really talk about the decay in the whole space-time, yeah. Okay, so what we proved is that logarithmic decay is not just an upper bound, but it's also a lower bound. So that means you cannot do any better than the logarithmic decay that we saw before. This is the precise, you know, statement for, you know, for the result. But then the, you know, main consequence is that this decay is sharp for the case of for the, you know, special case of gravitational solitons that we were looking at. And so what this means is that if I try to add another decaying function to this, that decay statement is just false. So that's the corollary of this theorem, or, you know, the major consequence. And good decay is, you know, inverse polynomial decay that you see for black holes is considered good decay. But this kind of slow decay is reminiscent of black rings. So when I say black rings, I don't mean the Gregory-Laflamme kind of instability. I'm talking about just the scalar wave equation on black rings and also Kerr ADS4. So there's a stable trapping that appears in the ADS boundary, that appears close to the ADS boundary, and a similar, you know, result is also applicable there. And in all these cases, the slow decay is due to the stable trapping of null geodesics. Okay, so from now on, I'm just going to, I cannot go through all the parts of the proof, but I'm going to try to give idea of what it is that we've tried to do in the proof. Okay, let's look at a model problem. Let's look at solutions of this form, and maybe just assume that you're looking at a 1 plus 1, case. What stable trapping means is that, when you do a separation of variables, then you have a minimum in your potential. So, you know, when you separate the wave equations and when you have this form, you will definitely have a minimum when you have stable trapping. And so the slow decay can be understood as being caused by bound state solutions that can form here, or, you know, that can actually solve this equation. So that is exactly the idea that we use. Find these bound state solutions, and then use those bound state solutions to get a lower bound for this energy. So you can think of this as, you know, the double wall potential, and the maximum dispersion that you would have, or decay that you would have, is because of, you know, tunneling. Okay, so, and this is exactly the same kind of, you know, technique that was these were all different geometries, but this was, you know, the same technique that was used here to prove a slow decay result. Okay, so now going back to the space-time that we have, we can do a separation of variables, you know, owing to the symmetry and all, and the, you know, eigenvalue problem that we have, which is, you know, analogous to this, is this problem. Now, it's not so simple because you have this term here which makes it a nonlinear eigenvalue problem. So you have omega squared, which is your eigenvalue, but then you have also this, okay. Now, so there are a few complications because of that. And so the first thing that we are going to do is.
What is f?
Okay, so sorry. So these are functions that come from the metric. Yeah, so it's, yeah, I've suppressed a lot of things too. Yeah, so this is the eigenvalue problem. And so what we're going to try to do is first see if the linear eigenvalue problem has a solution. So suppress this term, you know, with the boundary conditions. So you're looking at the Dirichlet.
So you have a term that's linear in omega. Why do you call that a nonlinear term?
Oh, if I want to think about this as an eigenvalue problem, then it has a dependence on omega. I mean, otherwise I wouldn't.
Why? So, I mean, even if you add that term, it seems to me it's still a linear problem. Why do you call it?
As f is a function of R, that's why you cannot.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yes. This is a function of R, and, well, this is also a function of a lot of things.
Nonlinear in R, that's what you...
Nonlinear... Well, I would say nonlinear in omega, because, well, I don't know, operator x on u is equal to lambda times u. Isn't that the usual eigenvalue problem? Here I have... lambda times u plus some square root of lambda times u, and I'm trying to solve that eigenvalue.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't call it a nonlinear problem. I mean, like for all quasi-normals of black holes, it's like that, right? Like for Kerr quasi-normal, you generally have terms that's quadratic omega, linear in omega. We're solving linear perturbations and it's linear eigenvalue problem.
So are we talking about quasi-normal modes?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm not sure if this would answer the question. So I'll eventually construct something on the whole space-time, but right now all I'm doing is trying to look at, you know, Dirichlet boundary value problem and construct a solution that's like bounded.
Uh-huh.
So that's, I mean, if I make a comparison with the Schrodinger equation, perhaps then this would just be, you know, I have my energy here, but then I have like the square root of energy again there. So that is the sense in which I'm calling it a nonlinear eigenvalue problem.
Okay.
I see. Okay. Yes, and yeah, and also, yeah, these are quasi modes and, yeah, not quasi normal modes. Okay, so what we do is first find, you know, solutions to the linear eigenvalue problem, you know, with the boundary condition, and then see if you can somehow extend the results from here to here. I mean, it happens you can actually do that. For eigenvalue problems of these form, so, you know, you have a parameter n here, you know, h is 1 over n. There is an existence for the number of eigenvalues, you know, close to something that's above the minimum through what is called the Weyl's law, and a slight modification just tells you that you can, you know, apply it here. And using implicit function theorem, you know, you can parametrize the non-linearity here, you know, with say a parameter beta, and you can extend, you know, you can go from the linear problem to the nonlinear problem, and so you can say, you can also establish that there are eigenvalues to the nonlinear problem as well. Now, this is crucial because, you know, we are claiming that there are bound state solutions which could potentially give you slower decay. So if I don't have any solutions to this, that statement is just not okay, right? So here we've proved that no, actually, you do have eigenvalues, and so you can construct bound state solutions. Okay, so, and these solutions are localized in the trap region, that is where you have a minimum to the potential. Okay, so once I construct those bound state solutions, that's only in a small region of space-time. That's not in the whole space-time. But also, I cannot just say, okay, I have, you know, this Dirichlet boundary conditions. Let me say that it's zero everywhere else. That might not even be continuous, right? So I want to smoothly extend it. So slightly before the boundary, I cut it off smoothly, but then the you know, the negative here is that it's no longer going to be a solution to the wave equation, right? It's going to induce a small error. And so it's going to solve this equation instead of the actual wave equation. And so we now think back about what is it that connects the solution to the homogeneous wave equation and the inhomogeneous wave equation. So we have a Duhamel's formula that connects these two. And using that, we can find certain bounds in terms of this parameter n for the energy. So from here, you can go through a construction and show that the best kind of decay that you can get is inverse logarithmic in time. And you cannot have a faster decay than that. So that is a rough idea of the proof. And I'll stop with some remarks. So now the above results don't really say that there are solutions that that cannot decay faster than logarithmically. It just says that that decay, whatever it is, it's not going to be uniform. So there'll always be solutions that'll decay slower than that. So you can, of course, always come up with initial data for the wave equation so that the solution is just faster than logarithmic, but it's not going to be true for all initial data. Okay. And the construction here, though the sharpness of the bound is something particular to solitons, because we have this upper bound and a lower bound, that is unique to solitons. But then the construction is applicable to any spacetime which exhibits stable trapping. So whenever you have a stable trapping, you have this minima in the potential, you can go ahead and construct these bound state solutions, and then they will give you a result that tells you that you cannot have anything better than logarithmic decay. So, stable trapping giving you slow decay is a very ubiquitous thing. Now, there are some open questions. So there are also bound states of solitons and black holes. Black holes have a horizon, and you can think of this horizon as giving you more decay. And then, you have solitons in this end, which have slower decay. So what is the structure of trapping there, and then what is the nature of decay there? What are the competing effects of, the horizon and stable trapping? That's an open question. And also, a point that was raised in the talk, what is the instability caused by stable trapping, or is there a dynamical instability that is caused by stable trapping? There's no known mechanism for it yet that I'm aware of. Okay, with that, I will end the talk. Thank you very much.
So this looks like a WKB method. So you first solve the equation with only the omega squared term, so you get the high frequency terms, right? And then you push the next order with the linear in omega term. Looks like a WKB
term. I think 7 years back when I studied quantum mechanics. But yes, a lot of this is used very much in quantum mechanics and spectral theory. So I would assume it's,
So this one over log squared behavior, log of the squared. So this is for this particular solitonic space time that came from supergravity. Or is it more general than that?
So there are microstates in other dimensions too, and I don't know if I mentioned. So one of the mathematicians, Joseph Kerr, had also looked at them. Some of them have logarithmic decay, but some of them also have what is called ergosphere, and that has even worse decay. As in, there are things that don't decay on the ergosphere, so it's worse than this. So there's logarithmic decay there, but then also it's much worse. So, and those are also soliton spacetimes. I think they are Kaluza-Klein though, but they are solitons.
So the slowly decaying solutions that you constructed, those would have high Engler number, or?
Yeah. That high number is also associated with the frequency. The omega grows as this angular number. So yeah, those are all for the high angular number. Yeah.
So is it the stable on the low omega?
Stable, yeah, I'm not sure about stable because, I mean, there's no like known proof for it, but it wouldn't have this kind of instability, yeah.
I have a stupid question. Mm-hmm. So when you say something is decaying, in this case, you mean that the energy is decaying?
Yeah, this energy, which is the square integral of phi.
My question is, where does the energy go then? Like,
Well, so when I say decay, I'm looking at this compact region, and then I'm looking at what happens as, you know, there is that space-like region, and then that evolves. What happens to the energy contained in the evolution of that region? So what that is the decay of the energy. So
the energy inside that region is decaying, which means that the energy is going out and moving to some neighboring regions?
Yes, like, yeah, infinity.
So
yes, exactly, yeah.
So basically, you mean the soliton is evaporating or something like that?
The scalar within the sol, it's not the soliton itself.
Yeah, the soliton is stationary and we are not really looking at any back reaction. So it's just whatever happens with the scalar field. Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So, I mean, ultimately, you are drawing conclusions out of analysis of these modes that exist because of a particular shape of the effective potential that your field is being affected by. So is there a general conclusion you can draw out? I mean, as I, if I were to play out, I mean, forgetting now for the moment that the model was this particular oscillon,
uh-huh.
But, I mean, as you imagine going to higher dimensions and the part of the potential is just determined by that dimensionality of your system. So it's 1 over R to whatever D minus 1 or whatever the power should be.
Mm-hmm.
So would it be more or less likely for the instability to be there? You see where I'm going? I'm trying to say this is a result for a very special case in a very special dimension.
Yes.
But what can one kind of take as a take home message for general scenarios? It's particular, I mean, of course, implicitly my bias is okay. What's going on in D equal 4?
Ah, okay, I see. So, yeah. So you know, to construct this quasi modes, we exploited all the symmetry, but. You know, the potential need not just be this one-dimensional potential well. You can also do it when it's, you know, two-dimensional. So the fact that you have such a minimum, I think that's the most important thing. But the construction itself isn't attuned to the solution that I have, or, you know, for that matter, to the symmetries of the solution that I have. For example, this construction was also carried out for black rings, right? And there, you know, you don't have this much of symmetry. You definitely cannot reduce it to this one-dimensional problem that I reduced it to, but still you can derive the same result. You know, you can, I mean, you have this minimum in a potential, and then you can construct these solutions. That I would think is the most important, artifact, which I would think is also not that much dependent on dimension. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, that I understand, but I mean, that will the minimum be more or less likely to happen?
Oh, less likely to happen. Oh, I see. So just from literature, higher dimensional, you know, solitons, which were called microstates, they had other issues, the ones I was mentioning, you know, ergospheres and instabilities caused due to that. But I don't know. I mean, if I maybe think about it just, you know, from classical mechanics or quantum mechanics, maybe I would have a deeper potential in higher dimensions. I'm not really sure. Yeah, I would have to think about it.
Well, yeah, that's what I was trying to think. I mean, there's a deep, if it has deeper potential in higher dimensions, then this would be contrary, I guess, to that thing that we both kind of remember, I think. that it's easier to have Minkowski be stable in higher dimensions than in lower dimensions. That's what I was trying to reconcile.
Oh, I see. Yes, yes. So one important thing here is, so the absence of a horizon causes, you know, all these issues. A horizon has a decaying mechanism, you know, that comes with it. So that is something that really gets in the way of decay, I would think, more than the dimension. Now, if you're asking, okay, can you go high enough that they both cancel out? I'm not really sure. So, you know, you can have higher dimensional black holes, which, you know, Myers-Perry, there are some decay results for Myers-Perry. So that certainly, you know, happens. This is...
Yeah, right, this... that's okay. Sorry, I was asking you to go fishing, but because and me coming with you, I was just thinking, even if I don't think of black holes to begin with, because I'm just thinking of stability of Minkowski, where I can relate some things to this result, but that's okay.
I'm
being very vague.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
No, that's a good point. Yeah, thanks.
Okay. So I think we're out of time. Thank you again, Sharmila,
thanks
for putting this together.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.